Okay, well, thanks. And
you can't say for your good.
I do actually. I really, especially John, I want to thank for he really handled all the organizing. It seems I hardly did anything. So thanks, John, for all that. I also want to thank my collaborators, Maria Chang, who's here, and Hae-young Shu and Jamie Pompa, and James Woods, not the actor, but the geographer. And thanks also to my former student, Roger Peng, and to Larry Bradshaw for generosity in sharing with me the weather data that I'm going to be talking about, as well as the Fire Family Plus software used to convert that to BI, Burning Index. And also the USDA Forest Service, the LA County Fire Department, the LA Department of Public Works, for their generosity in sharing with me their wildfire data. And the IOE, that means UCLA's Institute of the Environment, for some other extraneous data. Now, what I'm going to be talking about mostly today, statistically, is separable estimation of point processes, which is something that I think is useful for model building for point processes. But first, I want to talk about why I think there might be some room or desire for model building with respect to these indices and prediction of wildfire danger using weather variables. So first I'll talk about the burning index and why we might want to try to develop empirical sort of alternatives to it. Then I'll talk about separable estimation a bit, and finally with a view towards alternative fire prediction models. Okay, so first of all, the burning index. We got a nice summary of it yesterday, and the burning index is produced by the National Fire Danger Rating System, which produces the spread component and energy release component, and the BI is based on both of these, each of which is in turn based on dozens of equations. Now, Larry yesterday gave a very nice summary of these. I'm not sure if you all appreciated the complexity of these of the BI. So it's based on all these weather variables, as well as a drought index, vegetation information, and it's just extremely complicated to even compute. I guess you can't see this, but let's see if I go back. That doesn't work either. Well, you can maybe get just a vague flavor here, which is all I want to convey, of just all the equations that go into this. This is a page from Pine's book, Steve Pine. Anyway, there are a lot of equations. They're based mostly on heat transfer and moisture transfer. Some of them are nonlinear. Some of the equations are recursive. And so there's an incredible amount of complexity in it. Now, it's important to note that human interactions are not included in the model for the BI. And so this is important because in Los Angeles County, which is the data I'm going to be talking about, most of the fires are caused by humans, almost all of them. And there are other human interactions as well. So, of course, the fire department is going to try to put these fires out, and there's also fire prevention methods in place as well. So there are various human interactions, none of which the BI is going to take into account. So we can't expect the BI to correlate too well with empirical wildfire behavior for that reason alone. Now, the BI is based on Rothermel's 1972 paper primarily, which used these equations for heat transfer and moisture transfer to predict flame length based on experimental studies of fire. So it's the basis of it is to predict flame length. However, it's currently used in another way. So it's currently used, it seems to me, the National Fire Danger Rating System promotes its use as a sort of measure of the containability of a fire, which might correlate with, say, the area of a fire, or area per fire. But it's used by the LA County Fire Department as a sort of overall measure of fire danger. Now, I'm not sure, again, if this is how it was intended to be used, but that seems to be the way it's used. And I should say a little bit about my background into this area. When I first got involved, this story is a little bit like Haganush's story yesterday. When I first got involved with this, I looked at weather data and fire data going back to about 1900 and tried to tinker with some of the relationships in here and found some differences, at least in LA County, from the relationships that had previously been published about. And I talked to some of the people in the LA County Fire Department, and they were extremely congenial. I actually met with the assistant chief, the former assistant chief, and the current assistant chief of the LA County Fire Department. I told them what I'd found, and they said, yeah, that's nice, but we're going to stick with the BI. So apparently the BI is this well-agreed-upon predictor of wildfire hazard, and it's used, again, by the LA County Fire Department to predict the daily overall fire danger for the county. This is used for preparedness, for prevention measures, and for the issuance of warnings. Now, a few notes from yesterday on the predictive value of indices like the BI. Rob McAlpine said, this one index, the DFOS, works very well. David Martell said, to me, they work like a charm. Mike Watton said, they're well correlated with fuel moisture and fire activity over a wide variety of fuel types, and talking about the BI. Larry Bratt, or no, I'm sorry. That wasn't right. And Larry Bradshaw said, the Rothermel model is not necessarily accurate, but it's consistent, and went on to explain that by that he meant if you double the BI, let's say, in one area, then you're sort of like doubling the risk, and that BI is a good characterization of fire season. It seems to be very well agreed upon that the BI fits well and works great at predicting wildfires. The evidence to that is rather elusive, though. It could be just my ignorance, but I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that supports all these claims. Haganush gave us some nice evidence yesterday. I thought that was an excellent talk. So there was some nice evidence about, not the BI, though, but about the FPI and the Palmer Drought Severity Index. So she showed that the FPI was correlated with the probability of a large fire occurring, given that there was a fire, and that the Palmer Drought Severity Index was related to the number of large fires occurring in each pixel aggregated over all geographic areas and on a monthly scale. So some evidence that these indices seem to work okay was given there. And I haven't seen a whole lot more than that. Here's some other citations that I have seen. Haynes et al. In 1983 showed that the BI and the FPI were correlated with fire incidents and total burn area. Simmered in 1987 showed that the FPI is correlated with fire size. Let's see. The next row here, Mandalas and Yee and Viegas et al., they studied various European and Canadian indices. Viegas looked at Canadian and Portuguese indices as well as other European indices, but found that the Canadian and Portuguese indices seemed to provide the best fit to fires in southern Europe. Mandalas and Yee found that they could have substantial improvement using weather variables in addition to an index, to a fire danger index. Garcia Diaz and co-authors looked at an index that they themselves proposed called the Daily Fit Risk Index. I guess you could call that another index. And they looked at its fit to a 7-year period of fires in Galicia. And Cruz looked at the Canadian index in predicting the type and the ignition of experimental fires. But where's the evidence that the BI works? That seems, again, to be rather elusive, to me at least. Now, the spread, there are various papers that look at the effectiveness of fuel spread models. There are a host of problems with these as well, which I won't go into. But there certainly has been much written on those. So the first thing I'm going to do is look at how well it seems the VI correlates with wildfire activity in a very specialized location, that is Los Angeles County. Now, there's some nice things about looking at just a specialized location. First of all, we have an extraordinarily precise data set. A brief history about the fire department in LA County. It was formed in 1907. There are records even prior to that of wildfire activity. And it wasn't until about 1953 that the fire department was doing serious fire suppression. Before that, it was really just studying fire. And here's an example of what some of the data set looks like. The top left plot shows the burn areas in 1963 and 64 together. And if we look at just this rectangle here, I'm too nervous to draw it very well, I guess. Okay, if we look at that rectangle blown up, that's what I'm showing on the top right. But that's 63 and 64 together, and it turns out that this is the portion that burned in 1963, all this area, and the rest is what burned in 1964. And so we see just from this preliminary look at the data, there are many examples like this where it looks like there's some region that probably would have burned had it not burned in the previous year. And it's images like this which led to people looking at doing like prescribed burning and things like that. But it does seem that there's some evidence for the basic premise behind it. Anyway, I won't go into that now, but here's a plot just of the overall burn area by year. We don't see really any marked increase. Before about 1940, the data is not really considered that trustworthy. After about 1940, 1950, it's thought to be complete down to about 10 acres or 4 hectares. And the data are remarkably precise. These wildfire maps are thought to be accurate to within about 10 meters. Now, the previous talks were talking about 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer grids. Here we have precision down to like the 10 meter level. So the fire maps themselves are really very precise indeed. Note, by the way, that the temperature has been really dramatically increasing in Los Angeles quite steadily over more than a century. I always like to show this slide just so people see, and this isn't saying there's global warming, but certainly there's local warming in the cities. We see this in all cities, apparently. Okay, so I'm here in the brief history, and the National Fire Danger Rating System was started in 72, really implemented in 78, and there were some changes in the late 80s. And in 1976, these remote access weather stations, or RAWs, these are really remote and automatic, and they were implemented throughout the United States. And these weather stations automatically transfer their information to the national headquarters, which computes a burning index as well as other indices based on those weather variables. Here are the 16 or so stations in LA County. Don't ask me about how they're numbered, but those are the locations of them. A note about damages and how fires relate to the amount of damage. 2003 was a big year where there were 738,000 acres burned in Southern California. 3,600 homes were destroyed. 26 people died. And most of that was in about a one-week period. So just during this 8 or 9 day period, 700,000 acres were destroyed, 3,300 homes were lost, 20 people lost their lives in those wildfires. A note also, here are a couple of interesting examples of fires with very different burn areas and damages resulting. In the Bel Air fire in 1961, only 6,000 acres were destroyed, but it resulted in $30 million in damages. And that's in 1961. In the Clampett 1970 fire, 107,000 acres were destroyed, but only $7.4 million of damage. So the damage doesn't always connect exactly with the area burned. Okay. Now, what do we see when we look at the BI and wildfire incidents in Los Angeles County? There's good news and bad news. First, the good news. The BI is indeed positively associated with wildfire occurrence. And I should have said, I'm looking specifically at the data on the years where we have these remote access weather stations. So I'm looking just at 1976 data through the end of 2000. I apologize that it's kind of old data. I'll get to why that is the case maybe at the end of the talk if I have time. But a 25-year period from January 1976 to December 2000. Over that period, the BI is positively associated with wildfire occurrence. This plot shows that the BI is indeed higher on days when fires occur. The top plot is a histogram of the BI values over all the days in the data set. So this is the average over all those weather stations of the BI over all days. The middle plot is the histogram of the BI on days when wildfires occurred. And the vertical line shows the mean in both cases. And we could see how the mean increases on days when wildfires occurred. Great. So the BI is higher when wildfires occur. And the third plot shows the histogram of the BI for the days when the 50 biggest wildfires occurred in Los Angeles County over that 25-year period. Again, the mean increases on those days. Okay, so the BI is higher on days when wildfires occur. So that's good news. The BI is positively correlated with whatever measure of wildfire incidents you are looking at. That is, it's correlated with the number of fires that happen on a day, which is typically 0 or 1, but not always. It's correlated with the daily area burned, and it's correlated with the area per fire as well. All positive correlations. And the BI seems to properly emphasize, it really heavily emphasizes wind speed, apparently. Both wind speed and relative humidity, but especially wind speed. That is, higher wind speeds indicate higher risk, and that really seems to be the case. In fact, if we look at a kernel smooth plot of the relationship between area burned and wind speed, it looks remarkably similar to the same kind of smooth plot of the relationship between burn area and BI. So it looks from this like the BI is properly taking into account wind speed very heavily. So I consider this good news as well. Also, if we look at a plot like this, here's relative humidity on the x-axis, wind speed on the y-axis, and the color in here is the burning index. So for each pixel here, we average the burning index observed on those days when the relative humidity was in that range and the wind speed was in that corresponding range to that pixel. And so here we have the burning index indicated by the shading of the pixel, and on the right we have the burn area indicated by the shading. It's actually not white here on my screen, but it looks effectively white here. But we see a more interesting pattern if instead of burn area, we look at burn risk. That is, the proportion of times, the percentage of days when the relative humidity and wind speed were in that region and a fire was observed. And the pattern looks sort of similar to the pattern we see with burn index. So this sort of indicates that the burn index is doing a pretty good job of summarizing the relationship of the max relative humidity, that means the maximum relative humidity over the previous 24 hours, and wind speed, and the relationship with the probability of a wildfire occurring. Okay, and the evidence that I'm using to support that is simply that the shape of this picture sort of looks like the shape of this picture as well. So I say the BI is not bad at predicting incidents. It turns out its correlation is higher with number of fires or incidents of fires. And from looking at that previous plot, it seems like it's doing a decent job of picking up wildfire incidents. Okay. Some problems with the BI, though. For one thing, it seems, and this is the most minor of the problems, it seems like the BI is too additive in some senses. It's, if we look at the previous plot, for low wind and medium relative for some areas on this plot, for low wind and medium relative humidity, so sort of in this range, we see very few fires, but really the BI is not that low. These pixels are sort of dark. So that's one kind of problem. But over and over, we see that the BI seems to overemphasize situations where one of the variables seems very risky in terms of fires, like if we have high wind speed, but we have low temperature or high relative humidity. The BI will still be quite high, even though what really seems to be the case is that we need all these variables to be relatively conducive to wildfire ignition. So if we look at pairs of variables like this, and here we have smooth burn area shown inside the image, it looks like both temperature needs to be high and fuel moisture needs to be low. It doesn't help if one of them is conducive to wildfires if the other is not. Similarly, for other pairs of variables, precipitation just has to be zero, basically, in order for wildfires to occur on a day. And fuel moisture needs to be low as well. Of course, those two variables go hand in hand all the time anyway. Similarly, for precipitation and temperature, again, for wildfires, for big wildfires to happen, we need both of these to be conducive, not just one. And the BI seems in some ways to be too additive, and maybe a multiplicative model would be more appropriate. I'm not saying the BI is additive, it just sort of behaves like an additive model in some senses. We see this also if we look at, these are the 10 biggest fires in the data set here. So each line corresponds to one fire, and here we have the BI for that day, the average over the stations of the BI. Here we have the burn area, the wind speed, temperature, and precipitation. And for some of these, the BI sort of predicts it, it gets it, but for some of these it doesn't. If you can see there's a line here, the BI really missed this fire, where the temperature was pretty conducive to wildfire behavior. To wildfire ignition. The wind speed was quite high. The burn area was certainly very high, and yet the BI was really very low. So it sometimes misses fires like that. And I think the reason is that it's sort of too additive. Now, the other thing is the correlations between the BI and wildfire occurrence are rather low. The correlation between the BI and area burned on a given day is 0.09. It's not the R squared, that's R. And you might say, well, you wouldn't expect the correlation to be too high. After all, most of these fires are caused by humans. I do have a plot of the cause of them, but I don't think it'll appear too well. They're mostly caused by humans, and also the BI is used by the fire department, so there's a sense in which even if the BI were perfect, the fact that it's used for the preparedness of the LA County Fire Department would maybe give you reason to believe that even if it were a great predictor of wildfire danger, well, the fire department's ready for those days when the wildfire danger is high, and so it might not correlate with the actual burn area that well. Okay. On the other hand, there is some suggestion that there's only so much that fire departments can do in terms of decreasing the size of some of these fires. And so that may not be too much of an excuse. The other thing is that there's some sort of what David Friedman calls jujitsu going on here, in that if others are going to use the correlation to justify the use of the BI, then it seems that I should be justified in looking at that correlation as well. So the correlation between the BI and area burned is about 0.09. The correlation between the BI and the number of fires is higher, 0.13, which is a little curious, because that's you would think it would be the other way around. In fact, you would think that this correlation would be the highest of the three, but it's actually the lowest of the three. That is, the correlation between the BI and the area per fire. Now, disturbingly, the correlation between the date and the area burned is almost as high. I'm only looking at days when fires occurred here, and I'm looking at the area per wildfire as the response variable, as the other variable. Now, what if we looked at the correlation between the date and the area burned? What do I mean by date? If we look at, again, this doesn't really appear very well, but okay, the dashed line here is the burn area in the data set from 1976 to 2000, to the end of 2000. The solid curve is the burn area over the previous 25 years. And you could see that there's some similarity in the patterns. And this might suggest that if you were trying to predict the amount of area that's going to burn on a given day, that you might just use the sort of smooth, both of these are smooth averages, and you might just use the smooth average of what happened over the previous 25 years on that date as your estimate of burn risk. Okay, very naive thing. So this would be equivalent to what you might use as a predictor of wildfire risk if all you had was a calendar and knowledge of what happened over the previous 25 years, but no weather information at all. So you'd still have some correlation with burn area, and that correlation would turn out to be about 0.06. Okay. And if we just use the wind speed, we'd have a correlation of about 0.16. So higher burn area has a higher correlation with just wind speed than with the BI, which uses wind speed but also all these other variables. So that's a little disturbing as well. Okay. What's going wrong with the BI? Here's a plot of burn area and average wind speed. It does look like the relationship is not linear, but if we just fit a line to this anyway, the correlation would be about 0.16. Again, what's going on with... Before I get to what's going on with the BI, a couple of other plots. It was mentioned earlier that the BI is higher on days when wildfires occur and even higher on days when large wildfires occur. But this is true for all the other variables as well. Like, instead of BI, we could just use temperature, and that would be true, too. The temperature is higher on days when wildfires occur and on days when the biggest wildfires occur. Similarly, for wind speed. The wind speed is really high on the days when the biggest wildfires occur. So just having a correlation alone doesn't necessarily indicate that the model is perfect. And what could be going wrong? One thing that seems seriously wrong is that the BI is generally, again, this is just for LA over this 25-year period, but it's too high in the winter and too low in the fall. Here's a plot that shows the averages of the burning index values and the area burned over each month. So when it says 12 here, that means December. And numbers that are below the line indicate months in which the BI is rather high compared to what we see in terms of area burned. So these are months when the BI is too high, and look at them, December, January, February, March, especially December and January. And these are months when the BI is too low, and they're the crucial months. For LA, most of the burn area occurs in September and October, and that's exactly when the BI is not apparently doing such a great job. It's too low for those months. If we compare the area burned per day and the BI, now what I've done here is categorize according to different levels of BI the data. So, for example, here is all days when the BI is between 250 and 300. And this light one is for January and the dark one's for October. Now, if the BI were a perfect predictor of wildfire danger, we'd expect these two bars to be about similar, to have a similar shape, to be similarly heighted. But we don't. For the same BI, there's much greater danger in October than in January. So that's sort of unpleasant. if we throw in, if you might say I should have bigger bars of BI so that there's less variability, and I might throw in also some other months. So again, here, the first one is December, then January, and then October and November. And for December and January, for the same BI, there's much less burn area than in October and November. And we see this throughout, for all levels of BI. Something's going wrong. And the thing that seems to be going wrong is that the wind speed is actually not that low in January and December, even though there's never any burn area. Less than 2% of the total burn area occurs in December and January. So the BI is giving relatively high values in these months when there's sort of high wind speed, even though there's no risk of wildfire burns. So now to point processes. The question now is, what can be done instead? Well, instead, or if you're unwilling to go there, what can be done, what kind of models can be used to as a basis of comparison with the BI? And one option is to look at point process models. So we'll consider a point process model characterized by its conditional intensity with respect to time, location, and the area burned. So there's some information loss in the data in characterizing it this way. Here then are the points. So each point here would correspond to the centroid of a fire. And if we looked at, let's say, this is one given year, I think this is for 1993, each point here is then characterized by its centroid, and the size indicates the area that burned. So I'm throwing away the information on the exact locations that burn now. I'm just looking at the area of that fire. So I'm characterizing the probability of a fire of that area occurring at that location in that time. Here, by the way, is another way of looking at the whole data set. So here's month within the year, and here's year, and the size of the circle indicates the area of the fire. And so this is for the data set going back to 1960. And one thing I've been looking at is prototypes for point processes, which gives you a feeling of sort of a typical thing that happens in a year. And so at the top, I have sort of the prototype for that point process. This would say what we might observe in a typical year. Anyway, for such a point process, we'll say it's multiplicative in a certain mark. And I apologize for the notation here, but it's difficult to say exactly what I mean without it. We'll say a point process is multiplicative in a mark if we can write the conditional intensity as a product of the parameters governing that particular mark, let's say the area, times the a function of the parameters governing all the other variables. So each of these marks here can be multidimensional. For example, I'm thinking of X1 as location in practice, and X2 as area, but in general, these can be sort of arbitrary in their dimensionality. And the key thing here is that the different parameters are governing different marks, and that we can multiply these different components. Okay. And if this is true, and if one of the following conditions holds, then we can estimate the parameters governing that component separately from the other parameters. And this is a nicety for model construction. What this means is, again, we can estimate one component of the model separately from all the other components of the model. That's true if one of these conditions holds. And what this condition is saying, basically, is that the parameters governing all the other components of the model the conditional intensity governing the other components of the model is like a density. So this corresponds, in the case of earthquakes, people often assume that the magnitude of an earthquake follows some density that doesn't change. Well, I'm saying that density can change, but the integral of it is always going to be 1. And so if the integral is always equal to some constant, it doesn't even have to be a density, but if the integral of sort of the rest is always some constant, then we're fine. We can look at that other component's parameters separately from the rest. Similarly, if the component that we're estimating is a density, we can do that as well. And in addition, and this is the most important one in applications, I think, if it doesn't matter in terms of the integral, if the integral of your little partial likelihood, I'm sorry, your partial conditional intensity is the same as the integral of your overall conditional intensity for the full model, then again, the partial maximum likelihood will be equivalent to the overall maximum likelihood estimate. Now, why would this be the case? Often, for those of you who have done maximum likelihood in practice, you'll know that one of the checks that we use on maximum likelihood is you want to make sure that that integral term is about equal to n, the number of points in your data set. And this is going to be approximately true no matter if you're looking at just one component of the model, let's say temperature and its relation to the wildfires occurring on a given day, or if you're looking at the full model. So it's reasonable to suppose that, at least in some vicinity of the true parameters, both of these integrals are about equal to n. Well, if we constrain them to be exactly equal to n, then the partial maximum likelihood has all the nice properties that we know about for the overall maximum likelihood estimate. Now, I could see some saying, okay, I also have some other conditions. I'm sort of running out of time here, but I have some other conditions in which that result is true as well, where the partial maximum likelihood estimate is going to be equivalent to the overall maximum likelihood estimate. And this is for multiplicative models or for additive models, provided the sort of other term that you're ignoring for the moment is small relative to the term you're considering. Who cares? Well, I could see some people saying, why would anyone want to estimate a model separately when we know maximum likelihood works, where there's all this theory about it, there's software to implement it? Who would care about separately estimating parameters? The thing is, if you do maximum likelihood estimation in practice, it's difficult. First of all, you have to choose intelligent starting values. And if you're estimating many parameters, it just takes a while before you're sure that you've gotten the maximum. But there are other important reasons as well. For model building, this is the most important one to me. If I'm going to construct a model that's going to use all these different variables, there's some question of where on earth do I start? Well, if I know that, at least to a first approximation, it's okay if I look at each component individually, that can suggest a way to start. That is, I could look at, say, temperature and its relation to incidence. I could look at a plot of that, and that might suggest a functional form, a way to start. And I could then multiply each of these components together and at least obtain a rough guess at a model. In addition, well, closely related to this is the idea of dimension reduction. So if a point process satisfies these conditions, then there's some suggestion we can look at each component separately. That's not only important for model building, but also in evaluating the model. For looking at each of these functional forms, it's much easier if we can look at one variable at a time. And third, there's this notion that there's always going to be some variables that I'm excluding from my model. And as long as those variables aren't too important, there's a sense now in which it's possible that the exclusion of those variables doesn't totally invalidate the relationships that I might have found between other variables in wildfire incidents. To me, this is important because I teach my students about the dangers of ignoring possible confounding factors. We teach that to our undergraduate students. And yet I find in practice that's exactly what I'm doing. And whenever I've spoken in the past about wildfire research, there's always someone who says, what about X? Have you looked at cloud cover? Have you looked at earthworms? Have you looked at whatever variable that I haven't looked at that might be related to wildfire incidents? Well, at least there's some cover now. I can say at least there's some notion in which, although that variable might matter, its exclusion might not totally invalidate everything I've found. To me, that's important. Okay, for a few minutes now, I'll talk about steps towards the construction of alternative models. So first of all, wildfire incidence seems roughly multiplicative. There's a test for whether this can be, whether this is the case. It actually rejects the separability or multiplicativity of the model, but only marginally so. And given the size of the data set, maybe this is some evidence that a multiplicative model is not too bad here, actually. I looked at, with my graduate students, we looked at just four variables here, four of these weather variables that are included in the BI, and saw, tried to see how well can we predict wildfire occurrence using just those four variables. So wind speed, relative humidity, temperature, and precipitation. And the relationship between these variables is not linear, so it seems sort of exponential, the effect of wind speed, and also sort of exponential, the relationship with maximum relative humidity. And then temperature looks maybe roughly linear. And again, I'm not doing really good, I'm not trying to do really accurate modeling here. I'm just trying to get a simple alternative to compare to the BI. So I'm just going to say linear in temperature and linear with a, I didn't show the relationship with precipitation, but it looks sort of linear with kind of a cutoff. So that's what I fit. And then for the overall distribution of wildfire areas, a truncated Pareto model, I mean a tapered Pareto model seems to fit rather well. And so here's the model in terms of how these weather variables relate to the occurrence of, at time t. And this is meant to be a very simple model. I'm just looking at an exponential in humidity and wind speed, and then multiplying that by a linear term in temperature and a sort of linear with a truncated linear term in precipitation. That's it. So a really naive, dumb model. And I'm calling this model 1. And I'll look at the relative AICs. So for the AIC, lower is better, but I'm looking at the AIC for the Poisson model minus the AIC for that model. So higher now would be better. And sure enough, it's much higher for this model than it is for the BI. Of course, it's zero for a stationary Poisson model, and it's almost as high as the BI if I just had this this relative humidity term here, nothing else. Now, I know that looking at AICs is not going to convince the fire people. I'm using this talk as kind of a warm-up to a couple weeks from now when I'm meeting with the assistant fire chief in LA County. I know he's not going to say, oh, wow, the AIC is higher. That's great. But I tried to think what could be convincing to someone, and I made a plot like this. This shows for a given, if I imagine fitting that, looking, using that model and using a cutoff, if lambda is higher than a certain cutoff, and this relates to David Vere Jones's question yesterday, like how do we explain probabilities? Well, if I don't interpret lambda as a probability, but I say for a given cutoff, how many false alarms would there be in that year, and how many of the fires that occurred in that year would I correctly have gotten? I can make this kind of plot. And the solid curve is for the BI, and the dashed curve is for this naive model that I showed on the last page. So for every number of false alarms, the dashed curve does better. And it's not so dramatically apparent that it's much better here, but if we look at two values. So this corresponds to a BI of 150, which is sort of a benchmark used by the LA County Fire Department. Or here's BI equals 200, which is a very high Burney Index value. The differences are rather substantial. Look at this. So for a BI of 150, using the BI, we would have, if we use this cutoff, we'd have on average 32 false alarms per year. And skip to the right here. The percent of fires that we'd correctly get using that cutoff would be 22.3%. Now, if you use this naive model, and if you allow me to have 32 false alarms per year, I can get about 34% of the fires. Again, it's just using weather data. There's no reason it should predict many of these fires. If you let me have the same false alarm percentage, then I can predict about 63.4% of the fires correctly. But now I'm making over 100 alarms per year, which seems ridiculous. So it probably makes sense, more sense to just allow the same number of false alarms per year. If I use a BI of 200, that gives 13 false alarms per year. And if I use a cutoff in the model that amounts to 13 false alarms per year, I can do about twice as well. I can predict, instead of 8.2% of the fires correctly, about 15.1%. And this is using just a very naive model. In fact, I don't really want to promote this, promote the model here. I'm just using this to say that, really as evidence that maybe we need to consider alternatives to the BI, not to promote this particular model. There are ways in which this model could be substantially improved. So first of all, we have a smooth background rate of all the fires that have occurred, say, over the previous 25 years. That would help substantially, because there are certain areas where fires just never occur, and we need to incorporate that information. Time since fire, or fuel age, seems to be an important variable as well in predicting wildfire occurrence. So if we look here at the age of the fuel, that is, the time since that location last burned, and the proportion of fuel, meaning proportion of land of that age that burns in a given year, there seems to be some kind of significant relationship there, that older fuel burns a little bit more readily than younger fuel. Wind direction, I thought, would be a really important variable. In particular, in Los Angeles, there's this sort of hot, dry Santa Ana wind that comes in around every fall, and that's one of the reasons why fall is especially dangerous with respect to fire. When we look, though, at wind direction, we don't see much of a pattern here. It's not like there's certain days when the big fires occur and when the wind direction is in a certain direction on that day. At least it's hard to notice any major impact of wind direction so far. But it's something I'm looking into. We have data on land use and greenness and vegetation for LA County. Here's the land use. You can see very much of LA County is actually both the Santa Monica Mountains and the Angeles National Forest. So much of it is not industrial, and this is where most of the wildfires occur, of course. Here's a greenness map for all of California, and we know the vegetation. Of course, the vegetation type for Los Angeles County is relatively constant throughout. It's chaparral, and that makes LA County sort of a nice test case. But there are some variations. Now, another important thing to look at is precipitation. The precipitation over the previous days seems to be very strongly related to wildfire incidents. Here's a plot showing the average precipitation per day on the days preceding fires, and it's significantly lower than the 95% bounds you'd get if you looked at all days, if you thought all days were equivalent in terms of the precipitation on previous days. Now, that's very naive. But even if you looked at the BI, so there's even something missing from the BI with respect to precipitation over the previous days. And I'm puzzled by this, because the BI, one of the components in the BI, does take into account a drought severity index. Nevertheless, if we look here at the solid curve, that's showing for days when the BI is between 100 and 150, and there's a fire, the average precipitation over the previous days is considerably lower than other days when the BI is between 100 and 150. So there's something missing from the BI in terms of the average precipitation on previous days. Similarly for days when the BI is in the range of 150 to 200. It's much lower than you'd expect comparing it to all days when the BI is in that range, whether there are fires or not. Okay, let me go through the spatial interpolation and get to the conclusions. So all these conclusions are only for LA County data over this 25-year period. I don't know whether these will extend to other locations, and I recognize that the BI is made to serve the entire nation, the entire U.S., so it's certainly understandable that it wouldn't fit perfectly in L.A. County. The BI, nevertheless, is positively associated with fire incidents and burn area in L.A. County, although it's not a great predictor. Wind speed alone has a higher correlation with burn area, and a simple model using wind speed, relative humidity, precipitation, and temperature easily outperforms the BI in terms of prediction. The BI seems too additive, too high in winter, and too low in fall in particular. And the statistical conclusion that for multiplicative models and for additive models, as long as you haven't excluded something too dramatic, we can estimate the parameters separately. And this suggests building and testing, examining, that is, alternatives to the BI by looking at different covariates individually, at least as an initial guess. Wind speed, relative humidity, temperature, and precipitation all matter a lot. And other important variables like include spatial background, the date, and the date may be a proxy for the total amount of precipitation over the previous days. And the time since fire as well. It seems to matter considerably as well. That's it. Thanks. Weekends would be interesting. So a lot of these, a substantial amount of these fires are thought to be caused by campers. And that may be another reason why the fall is dangerous. It's just nice to camp in L.A. in the fall. So there may be a sense in which if the weather is too extreme, you actually don't see fires because people aren't out there camping. I don't really have data on the cause of fires for the L.A. County, but I have seen it for California. And I wonder if you can see it here. Is there a way to... Great, thanks. I don't know if you can see this, but so very 1.3% are caused by lightning. All the rest are caused by humans in some way. Sometimes arson, about 10% arson, but a lot are caused by miscellaneous things, debris burning. Car accidents apparently cause a lot of them, and so and equipment use, so factories, factory output as well. Playing with fire, yeah. People. Yeah, hi, Kanish. That's right.